Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice, reporting from the heart of East County. Today we are devoting the first half of our show to a special report on the Select Committee investigating the January 6th Capitol insurrection in Congress, including highlights of emotional testimony by Capitol police officers who valiantly defended our nation's capital against a violent mob of attackers. On the second half of our show today, we'll have a report on the federal government declaring long COVID a disability, plus the latest on COVID-19 cases locally, a new county masking recommendation, and troubling findings about the highly contagious Delta variant. Before you hit the beach, be sure to check out the list of sunscreens that have just been recalled. We'll be sharing those later on our show. San Diego County Sheriff Bill Gore has announced that he won't be seeking re-election. We'll have some highlights from his career as well as controversies, and you can find out who's taking aim at the seat on our show today. And in La Mesa, 8 candidates have signed up so far to run in a special election to replace Dr. Akilah Weber, who won election to the State Assembly. We'll have highlights on who's running on today's show. Then from California News Service, hear about a plastic waste recycling initiative that's qualified for the statewide ballot and how the new proposed state budget seeks to address racial disparities in the juvenile justice system. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital. This is Miriam Raftery on KNSJ with a special report on the opening day of testimony before the House Select Committee on the January 6th insurrection. 4 police officers gave emotional testimony revealing how the mob violently assaulted, tortured, and nearly killed law enforcement officers defending the Capitol. The officers endured beatings, eye gouging, tasering to the head, death threats, and lasting injuries. Much of their testimony was backed up by newly released body cam video footage shown, which revealed supporters of Donald Trump brutally attacking the officers who implored congressional members to assure that everyone responsible is held accountable. The House committee includes Republicans Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, along with Democrats. Senate Republicans filibustered any effort to appoint an independent bipartisan commission, as was done to investigate the 9/11 attacks, seeking to squelch any investigation. So Speaker Nancy Pelosi appointed members of both parties and invited House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy to name additional members. But after Pelosi vetoed 2 of McCarthy's 6 picks because of conflicts of interest, since the 2 could be called as witnesses and actually possible co-conspirators, McCarthy withdrew all 6 of his nominations and he refused to name any more. Both McCarthy and Senate Republican Leader Mitch McConnell have said they did not watch the hearing, citing other business commitments. But for much of the nation that tuned in to watch the riveting testimony, the evidence presented was deeply powerful and disturbing. Committee Chairman Benny Thompson provided opening remarks, and here's an excerpt.
We're going to be guided solely by the facts of what happened on January 6th in the run up to that tragic day and what has taken place since. That's what we're charged to do by House Resolution 503. There's no place for politics or partisanship in this investigation. Our only charge is to follow the facts where they lead us. And while we have a lot to uncover, there are a few things we already know. We know that the insurrection on January 6th was a violent attack that involved vicious assault on law enforcement. We know there's evidence in a coordinated, planned attack. We know that men and women who stormed the Capitol wanted to derail the peaceful transfer of power in this country. We know that 7 people lost their lives, that more than 140 police officers suffered injuries. We know that efforts to subvert our democracy are ongoing, and a major part of the Select Committee's work will be to find ways to eliminate that threat. We also know that the rioters came dangerously close to succeeding. If not for the heroism of the United States Capitol Police and the Metropolitan Police Department, many more lives might have been lost, and the rioters could have accomplished what they set out to do, upend American democracy. It's an honor to have four of these heroes sitting before us today. We welcome them for appearing here, and more importantly, for your heroism on January 6th. You have the gratitude of this committee and this country. You held the line that day. I can't overstate what was on the line, our democracy. You held the line. We're going to revisit some of those moments today, and it won't be easy, but history will remember your names and your actions. And it's important to think about history as this committee starts its work, and as we hear from these courageous men to get answers for the American people, because we need to understand our history if we want to understand the significance of what happened on January 6th and our role as members of the People's House. I'm talking about the peaceful transfer of power. 200 years ago, in 1801, the House of Representatives did one of its jobs laid out in the Constitution. After a deadlock in the Electoral College, this body cast 36 ballots and ultimately settled the contest for President of the United States. What followed was the first peaceful transfer of power in our country's history. We know that since then, our history has been far from perfect. We've been torn apart and brought back together. We've struggled across generations to make our country's great vision a reality for all Americans. We won victories and we've suffered failures. But the peaceful transfer of power has stood as the pillar of our democracy. It's one of those things we rely on, a safeguard that we hold close, because as heated and angry and divided as we may be, whatever victories we celebrate or upheavals we endure, we can rest easy knowing that when the moment comes, our system guarantees that one party will hand the reins to another if that's the will of the people. And while our institutions endure, and while Joe Biden is the legitimately elected president of the United States, a peaceful transfer of power didn't happen this year. It did not happen. Let that sink in. Think about it. A violent mob was pointed toward the Capitol and told to win a trial by combat. Some descended on this city with clear plans to disrupt our democracy. One rioter said that they weren't there to commit violence, but that, I'm quoting, "We are just there to overthrow the government." I want to repeat that. I urge everyone to listen to those words and think about what they mean. We were just there to overthrow the government. They marched on the Capitol with the clear intentions of stopification of the election. And when they encountered the police sworn to keep us safe, they went on the attack with bear spray, knives, tasers, hockey sticks, even flagpoles fashioned in clubs, hoops with the American flag still attached. And those rioters breached the Capitol. They smashed windows, scaled walls, opened doors, and invaded the halls of Congress. It was a scene of violence in the citadel of our democracy, not seen since 1814, when British soldiers sacked the building. They raced through the hallways chanting, "Hang Mike Pence. Where's Nancy?" They stormed onto the Senate floor because they wanted to stop the Senate from certifying the election. The rioters tried to take over the House floor for the same reason. Thankfully, some astute young staff member had the presence of mind to grab the physical electoral ballots for safekeeping. These rioters were organized. They were ready for a fight, and they came close to succeeding. It's frightening to think about how close we were. A few inches of wood and glass. An officer turning left instead of turning right. But just describing that attack doesn't come close to capturing what actually took place that day. So we're going to see some of what our witnesses saw on January 6th. Let's see the video, please. But please be advised that it contains graphic images and strong language, which many may find disturbing.
And we're going to play just a small excerpt of that tape that was very long, but enough for you to hear some of the terrifying exchanges between the officers and the rioters.
Hey, brother, we're boots on the ground here. We're moving on to Capitol now. I'll give you a boots on the ground update here in view.
Multiple Capitol entries! Multiple Capitol entries! We are still taking metal, sharpened objects, missiles, to include bottles and rocks, and hand-thrown chemical-grade fireworks. This is now effectively a riot.
1349 hours declaring it a riot.
Okay, guys, apparently this tip of the spear has entered the Capitol building.
Oh, if I give this up, they're going to have to run after. At least this Capitol we can defend. We got to hold what we have.
Take your pins off.
Yeah.
Take your pins off.
The chairman then introduced four police officers who described their nightmarish ordeal, fearing for their lives as they battled the angry mob to save our democracy, protect the Capitol, and our elected officials. The first to testify was Capitol Police Officer Aquilino Gunnell, and we're going to air his testimony in full because it's so compelling and warning. Some of this is very disturbing.
I now recognize Sergeant Gunnell to summarize his testimony.
Good morning, everybody.
Morning.
Chairman Thompson, members of the Select Committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify regarding the attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. It is with honor and heavy heart that I come before you to tell you my story from a painful firsthand experience what happened that terrible day at the Capitol. Providing this testimony solely on my personal capacity and not as a representative of the U.S. Capitol. It is imperative that the events of January 6th are fully investigated and the Congress and the American people know the truth of what actually occurred and that all those responsible are held accountable, particularly to ensure that horrific and shameful event in our history never repeats itself. I applaud you for pursuing this objective. Even though there's overwhelming evidence to the contrary, including hours and hours of videos and photographic coverage, there's a continuous shocking attempt to ignore or try to destroy the truth of what truly happened that day, and to whitewash the facts into something other than what they all mistakenly reveal, an attack on our democracy by a violent domestic extremists, and a stain on our history and our moral standing here, home and abroad. As a child in the Dominican Republic, I look up to the United States as the land of opportunity and a place of. And from that moment I landed at JFK in 1992, I has tried to pursue that goal. Thankfully, I achieved that goal on many levels. I was the first in my family to graduate college, join the Army, and become a police officer. On July 23rd, 1999, the day before my 24th birthday, I raised my hand and swore to protect the Constitution of the United States. Because this country gave me an opportunity to become anything that I wanted. At that time, I already started basic training with the Army Reserves. In fact, I raised my hand several times in ceremonies to pledge my commitment to defend and protect the Constitution of the United States. When I joined the Army Reserves, when I was promoted to Sergeant War in the Army, when I was promoted during my naturalization ceremony, and when my reenlistment in the Army, when I joined the United States Capitol Police, and lastly, when I was promoted to Sergeant 3 years ago, I have always taken my oath seriously. On January 6, 2021, I fulfilled my oath once more. This time to defend the U.S., the United States Capitol, and members of Congress carrying out their constitutional duties to certify the results of the November 2020 presidential election. To be honest, I did not recognize my fellow citizens who stormed the Capitol on January 6th, or the United States that they claimed to represent. When I was 25 years old and then a sergeant in the Army, I had deployed to Iraq for Operation Iraqi Freedom. From time to time, I volunteered to travel on IED-infested roads to conduct supply missions for U.S. and allied forces and local Iraqi population as well. But on January 6th, for the first time, I was more afraid to work at the Capitol than my entire deployment to Iraq. In Iraq, we expected the armed violence because we were in a war zone. But nothing in my experience in the Army or as a law enforcement officer prepared me for what we confronted on January 6th. The verbal assaults and disrespect we endured from the rioters were bad enough. I was falsely accused of betraying my oath, of choosing my paycheck over my loyalty to the U.S. Constitution. Even as I defended the very democratic process that protected everyone in the hostile crowd. While I was at the Lower West Terrace at the Capitol, working with my fellow officers to prevent the breach and restore order, the rioters called me a traitor, a disgrace, and shouted that I, an Army veteran and a police officer, should be executed. Some of the rioters had the audacity to tell me there was nothing personal, that they will go through me, through us, police officers, to achieve their goal, as they were breaking metal barriers to use as a weapon against us. Or they use more menacing language. If you shoot us, we all have weapons, we will shoot back. Or we'll get our guns, we outnumber you. They say, join us. I heard specific threats to the lives of Speaker Nancy Pelosi and then also Vice President Mike Pence. But the physical violence we experienced was horrific and devastating. My fellow officers and I were punched, kicked, shoved, sprayed with chemical irritants, and even blinded with eye-damaging lasers by a violent mob, apparently saw us, law enforcement, officer dedicated to ironically protecting them as U.S. citizens, as an impediment to their attempted insurrection. The mob brought weapons to try to accomplish their insurrectionist objectives and use them against us. These weapons included hammers, rebars, knives, baton, and police shields taken by force, as well as bear spray and pepper spray. Some of the riders wore tactical gear, including bulletproof vests and gas masks. The rider also forcibly took out batons and shields to use them against us. I was particularly shocked at seeing the insurrectionists violently attack us with the very American flag that they claimed to sought to protect. Based on the coordinated tactics we observed and verbal commands we heard, it appears that many of these attackers had law enforcement or military experience. The rioters were vicious and relentless. We found ourselves in a violent battle, desperate to attempt to prevent the breach of the Capitol by the entrance near the inauguration stage. Metropolitan police officers were being pulled into the crowd. We have one right here, right next to me. As we tried to push the rioters back for the breach in the Capitol, in my attempt to assist two MPD officers, I grabbed one by the officer by the back of the collar and pulled him back to the police line. When I tried to help the second officer, I fell on top of some police shields on the ground that were slippery because the pepper spray and bear spray. Riders immediately began to pull me by my leg, by my shield, by my ear strap on my left shoulder. My survivor's instincts kicked in and I started kicking and punching as I tried in vain to get MPD officer attention behind and above me. But they could not help me because they also were being attacked. I finally was able to hit the rider who was grabbing me with my baton and able to stand. And then I continued to fend off new attackers as they kept rotating and attacking us again and again. What we were subjected that day was like something from a medieval battle. We fought hand to hand, inch by inch, to prevent an invasion of the Capitol by a violent mob intent on subverting our democratic process. My fellow officers and I were committed to not letting any rioters reach the Capitol. It was a prolonged and desperate struggle. The rioters attempted to breach the Capitol were shouting, "Trump, send us. Pick the right side. We want Trump." I vividly heard officers screaming in agony and pain just an arm's length from me. I didn't know at that time that was Officer Hodges, and he's here today to testify. I too was being crushed by the rioters. I could feel myself losing oxygen and recall thinking to myself, this is how I'm going to die, defending this entrance. Many of the officers fighting alongside me were calling for shields because their shields had been stripped from them by the rioters. I was one of the few officers left with a shield, so I spent the majority of my time at the front of the line. I later find out that my wife and relatives were here in the U.S. and abroad, were frantically calling and texting me from 2 p.m. onward because they were watching the tomorrow on television. It was now until 4:26 p.m. after giving CPR to one of the rioters who breached the Capitol in an effort to save her life that I finally had a chance to let my own family know that I was alive. After order has been restored at the Capitol in many hours, I arrive at home at nearly 4 a.m. on January 7th. I had to push my wife away from me because she wanted to hug me. And I told her no because of all the chemical that my uniform had on. I couldn't sleep because the chemical reactivated after I took a shower. And my skin was burning. I finally fell asleep 2 hours later, completely, physically, and mentally exhausted. Yet by 8 o'clock a.m., I was already back, my way back to the Capitol. And I continued to work for 15 consecutive days until after the inauguration. I made sure to work despite my injuries because I wanted to continue doing my job and help secure the Capitol complex. More than 6 months later, I'm still trying to recover from my injuries. Many of my fellow Capitol officers, as well as MPD officers, suffer several physical injuries from the violence inflicted on us on January 6th. I sustained injuries on both my hands, my left shoulder, my left calf, and my right foot. I already had undergone bone fusion surgery on my right foot, and I was just told that I need surgery on my left shoulder. I have been on medical and administrative leave for much of the past 6 months, and I expect to need further rehabilitation for possibly more than a year. There are some who express outrage when someone kneels while calling for social justice. Where are the same people expressing the outrage to condemn the violence attack on law enforcement, the Capitol, and our American democracy? I'm still waiting for them. As Americans in the world watching horror what was happening at the Capitol, we did not receive timely reinforcement and support we needed. In contrast, during the Black Lives Matter protest last year, U.S. Capitol Police had all the support we needed and more. Why the different response? Were it not for the brave members of the MPD and later on from other law enforcement agencies, I'm afraid to think what could have happened on January 6th. I want to publicly thank all the law enforcement agencies that responded to assist that day for their courage and their support. I especially want to thank those Capitol Police officers who responded on their own from home after working midnight shift. Despite being outnumbered, we did our job. Every member of the House of Representatives, senators, and staff member made it home. Sadly, as a result of that day, we lost officers, some really good officers. But we held the line to protect our democratic process, because the alternative would have been a disaster. We are not asking for medals, recognition. We simply want justice and accountability. For most people, January 6th happened for a few hours. But for those of us who were in the thick of it has not ended. That day continues to be a constant trauma for us literally every day, whether because of our physical or emotional injuries or both. While it has not received much attention, sadly, many of my colleagues have quietly resigned from the Capitol because of that day. I'm also regularly called by law enforcement officials and prosecutors to help identify from photographs and videos the rioters. And to be honest, physical therapy is painful and hard. I could have lost my life that day, not once, but many times. But as soon as I recover from my injuries, I will continue forward and proudly serve my country in the U.S. Capitol Police. As an immigrant to the United States, I'm especially proud to have defended the U.S. Constitution and our democracy on January 6th. I hope that everyone in the position of authority in our country has the courage and conviction to do their part by investigating what happened on that terrible day and why. This investigation is essential to our democracy, and I'm deeply grateful.
This is Miriam Raftery on KNSJ with a special report on the opening day of testimony before the House Select Committee on the January 6 insurrection. Four police officers gave emotional testimony revealing how the mob violently assaulted, tortured, and nearly killed law enforcement officers defending the Capitol. The officers endured beatings, eye gouging, tasering to the head, death threats, and lasting injuries. Much of their testimony was backed up by newly released body cam video footage shown, which revealed supporters of Donald Trump brutally attacking the officers who implored congressional members to assure that everyone responsible is held accountable. The House committee includes Republicans Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, along with Democrats. Senate Republicans filibustered any effort to appoint an independent bipartisan commission, as was done to investigate the 9/11 attacks, seeking to squelch any investigation. So Speaker Nancy Pelosi appointed members of both parties and invited House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy to name additional members. But after Pelosi vetoed two of McCarthy's six picks because of conflicts of interest, since the two could be called as witnesses and actually possible co-conspirators, McCarthy withdrew all six of his nominations and he refused to name any more. Both McCarthy and Senate Republican Leader Mitch McConnell have said they did not watch the hearing, citing other business commitments. But for much of the nation that tuned in to watch the riveting testimony, the evidence presented was deeply powerful and disturbing. Committee Chairman Benny Thompson provided opening remarks, and here's an excerpt.
To you for undertaking, I'm happy to assist as I can and answer any question you may have to the best of my ability. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your riveting testimony, Sergeant Gunnell.
Three other officers testified next, and we don't have enough time on our show to air all of their testimony, but here's a summary. D.C. Metro Officer Michael Fanone nearly died after he was beaten viciously to unconsciousness by the mob and suffered a heart attack. They grabbed his radio and weapon. His testimony and video revealed a rioter shouting, "Get his gun! Kill him with his own gun!" And then he states, "I was electrocuted again and again with a taser." Believing he was about to die, he pleaded, "I have kids." Fellow officers managed to drag him to safety, and he was taken to a hospital with multiple life-threatening injuries. He now suffers post-traumatic stress disorder, he told the panel. At least one member of Congress has described this violent mob as tourists, and many in the Republican Party have tried to downplay ties by GOP members to some of the insurrectionists, despite the fact that the mob had erected a gallows outside the Capitol and were heard on tape threatening to kill Republican Vice President Mike Pence as well as members of Congress. They also tried to halt counting and certification of votes in the presidential election. In a flash of anger, Officer Fanone slammed his fist on the table at the hearing and said, "The indifference being shown to my colleagues is disgraceful." And he added, "Nothing has prepared me to address those elected members of our government who continue to deny the events of that day and in doing so betray their oath of office." D.C. Metro Police Officer Daniel Hodges was seen in a viral video being crushed in a doorframe by the mob and having his gas mask ripped off. The domestic terrorist bashed his head, kicked his chest, sprayed him with a chemical irritant such as tear gas or bear spray, pulled a mask over his eyes to blind him. Hodges told congressional members, one attacker told Hodges he would die on his knees. He screamed for help, and fortunately he was rescued by fellow officers. He described the attackers as terrorists who broke apart fencing and bike racks outside to use as weapons if they didn't bring their own. He also voiced disgust that some in the mob were carrying the thin blue line flag, a symbol of support for law enforcement, while they violently assaulted officers. Hodges implored congressional committee members to find out if anyone in power coordinated or abetted or tried to downplay, tried to prevent the investigation of this terrorist attack. They also heard testimony from Capitol Police Officer Harry Dunn, who was black. He said the insurrectionists shouted racial slurs at him. "No one had ever called me a nigger while wearing my Capitol Police uniform," he said. Dunn voiced anger at those who have sought to distort what happened or cast blame on others. "Why is telling the truth hard?" he asked, noting that the insurrectionists were clearly Trump supporters, many of them wearing MAGA hats and chanting "Stop the Steal," a reference to Trump's unsubstantiated claim that he won the election, a claim that over 60 courts rejected, including judges appointed by Trump. Officer Dunn then suggested that former President Trump bears responsibility for inciting the mob to violence. He testified, "If a hitman is hired and he kills somebody, the hitman goes to jail. But not only does the hitman go to jail, but the person who hired them does. There was an attack carried out on January 6th, and a hitman sent them," Officer Dunn concluded. Dunn also asked the congressional members to allocate additional funds for mental health counseling for officers traumatized by the events on January 6th. Dozens of officers were injured, some permanently, and two have committed suicide after the Capitol attack. Members of the bipartisan committee thanked the officers for defending their lives and protecting democracy. Democrat Adam Schiff said, "If we're no longer committed to a peaceful transfer of power after our elections, if our side doesn't win, then God help us." The two Republicans on the committee also condemned the violence and vowed to hold those responsible for it accountable. Representative Kinsinger made clear that he views the violence as an attempted coup and condemned some of his colleagues in the GOP for trying to cover up the truth. "Is it disservice to the officers and their families, to staff and employees of the Capitol complex, to the American people who deserve the truth, and to the generations who went to war before us to defend self-governance," Kinsinger stated. Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney told the officers, "The videos show the unbelievable violence and the inexcusable cruelty that you all faced, and people need to know the truth. We cannot leave the violence of January 6th and its causes uninvestigated." She added, "If Congress does not act responsibly, this will remain a cancer on our constitutional republic. We will face the threat of more violence in the months to come and another January 6th every 4 years." Cheney made clear she's been a conservative Republican since 1984 when she voted for Reagan and disagrees on policy sharply with Democrats. But she made clear, "In the end, we are one nation under God. The framers of our Constitution recognize the danger of the vicious factionalism of partisan politics. When a threat to our constitutional order arises, as it has here, we are obligated to rise above politics." She then said we must enforce subpoenas promptly, adding pointedly, "No member of Congress should now attempt to defend the indefensible, obstruct the investigation, or whitewash what happened that day. Our children will know who stood for truth, and they will inherit the nation we hand to them, a republic, if we can keep it." Now, it's worth noting that among San Diego's congressional delegation, four members voted in favor of forming the special committee to investigate the January 6th Capitol insurrection, and one voted against it, Republican Congressman Daryl Issa. Media coverage of the hearing showed the schism not only in Congress and our nation, but the news media. Some stations aired the testimony in whole or in part, but Fox News failed to air any of the police officers' testimony, while one Fox commentator went so far as to call the officers crisis actors. But for police officers around the nation, many of whom have long voted Republican in the past, the treatment of their fellow officers who risked their lives to defend the Capitol is disheartening and feels like a betrayal. East County Magazine's editor spoke with several La Mesa police officers at an event this week to introduce the new La Mesa police chief, and all of them voiced dismay and disgust at what they view as the whitewashing of attacks on police officers who defended the Capitol and the belittling of their bravery by some conservative media pundits. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interests, not special interests. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
Though many people recover quickly from COVID-19, some experience symptoms that can last for weeks or months. This can happen to anyone who has had COVID-19, even if the initial illness was mild. People with this condition are sometimes called long haulers, and the condition they have is known as long COVID. Some experience debilitating long-term impairment that can limit their activities. On the 31st anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act, or ADA, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Department of Justice have published new guidelines stating that long COVID can be a disability under the ADA as well as under the Affordable Care Act. With the rise of long COVID as a persistent and significant health issue, the HHS Office for Civil Rights and the DOJ Civil Rights Division have joined together to provide this new guidance on how these laws may apply, Each of these federal laws protects people with disabilities from discrimination. Assistant Attorney General Kristen Clark at the Justice Department Civil Rights Division says the ADA is one of our most transformative civil rights laws, helping to ensure that our schools, courthouses, town halls, businesses, and workplaces are open to all people, regardless of their disability status. She adds that the department is committed to making sure that people understand their rights under federal non-discrimination laws, and she states the Department of Justice will vigorously enforce the ADA and other federal civil rights laws to ensure that as the nation responds to and recovers from COVID-19, and that those with disabilities are full and equal partners in that recovery. The new guidelines and a directory of resources was shared by the White House as part of a comprehensive package of resources for people with long COVID, which you can find at thewhitehouse.gov in the briefing room section. Allison Berkoff, acting administrator and assistant secretary for aging, says it's critical that we ensure people who have disabilities as a result of long COVID are aware of their right under federal non-discrimination laws. It also is crucial that they know how to connect to services and supports available if they now need assistance to live in their own homes, go to school or work, or participate in their communities. This guidance is one of many actions that Health and Human Services has taken in recent months to address long COVID. In February, HHS launched a new initiative to study long COVID in hopes of finding ways to treat or prevent these symptoms. HHS also held listening sessions on long COVID with health advocates, and the National Institute of Health held a workshop with experts to identify gaps in knowledge about the condition. If you believe that you or another person has been discriminated against by an entity covered by federal civil rights laws, you may file a complaint with the Justice Department Office of Civil Rights. For discrimination against by an entity covered by the Americans with Disabilities Act, you may file a complaint with the Disability Rights Section in the Department of Defense. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Mitchell Murphy.
With cases of the Delta variant of COVID-19 surging, San Diego County has announced its recommendation for everyone to wear masks in indoor public places. The recommendation is in line with the latest Centers for Disease Control federal guidelines. The rate of COVID-19 cases in San Diego County is rated high by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. New research just released by the CDC reveals that the Delta variant is as easily transmissible as chickenpox or measles. Cases of COVID spiked over 82% in a single day this week locally, with cases also rising nationwide, primarily in unvaccinated people, who account for over 99% of the recent cases and hospitalizations from COVID-19 in San Diego County. County health officials are urging everyone to get vaccinated. A county press release states, "Masks are an added measure. Vaccinations are critical for getting back to the things we love." Now, in some places, vaccinations are becoming mandatory. The state and federal government have just announced initiatives to require vaccinations of state and federal workers unless you have a medical exception or a religious exemption. And in addition, some large companies, including Google, have announced that they will be requiring all employees to be vaccinated. And in San Francisco, the Bar Owners Association, after noting an alarming decline in customers who were concerned about contracting COVID and a rise in COVID cases taking bartenders off work for weeks at a time, has announced its recommendation for all of its member bars in the San Francisco Bay Area to require that customers be vaccinated. And according to an interview with the association's president on NPR, nearly all of the bars have agreed to require their customers to show proof of vaccinations. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Using sunscreen is important to prevent skin cancer, but now two popular brands of sunscreen, Neutrogena and Aveeno, both made by Johnson & Johnson, have been recalled due to contamination with benzene, a cancer-causing chemical. The recall includes only aerosol spray products in cans, not lotions. The recalled aerosol products include Aveeno Protect and Refresh, as well as Neutrogena's Beach and Defense, Cool Dry Sport, Invisible Daily, and Ultra Sheer. Johnson & Johnson says that it is recalling the products out of an abundance of caution, even though the levels of benzene detected are low and not expected to cause adverse health consequences. An investigation into the cause of the contamination is underway. The products were sold nationwide through many retail outlets. Consumers should stop using these products and discard them or return them to retailers. Consumers can contact Johnson & Johnson's Consumer Care Center, which is open 24/7 at 1-800-458-1673 to request a refund or ask questions. If you have any health issues you believe may be related to the sunscreens, you can contact your doctor. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Mitchell Murphy.
San Diego County Sheriff Bill Gore has announced that he will not seek re-election in 2022. Sheriff Gore, who is 73 years old, has served three terms of office, which will end January 2023. Sheriff Gore issued a statement saying, "Being your sheriff is one of the most rewarding experiences of my law enforcement career, rewarding primarily because of the extraordinary men and women in the department who work tirelessly every day to keep San Diego the safest urban county in the nation." His department serves the county's unincorporated areas and contracts with nine local cities as well, including Lemon Grove and Santee here in East County. His decision not to seek re-election leaves an open seat for sheriff in San Diego County, which has over 3 million residents and is the fifth largest county in the U.S. based on population. The sheriff has a 47-year career in law enforcement. Gore has served as Assistant Director of the Federal Bureau of Investigations, or FBI, where he helped pioneer the first Cyber Crimes Squad and Joint Terrorism Task Force. A Navy veteran raised in San Diego, he comes from a law enforcement family. In a 2018 interview with East County Magazine, Gore took credit for helping drop the county's crime rate to the lowest in 30 or 40 years. He credited that drop with use of technology and taking a proactive approach to crime, as well as forming collaborative partnerships with federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies to help nab criminals early. He also worked with the U.S. Attorney in San Diego to form the first regional forensics laboratory in the United States. But Sheriff Gore has also drawn criticism for San Diego County's jails and detention centers, which have the highest rate of inmate deaths of any large county in California, a matter that the state legislature is considering having an independent auditor investigate. Use of force controversies, racial tensions, and lawsuits over concealed carry permits have also been issues during his tenure. Sheriff Gore's decision not to seek re-election opens the San Diego County Sheriff's seat for the first time in a dozen years. At least one candidate is already taking aim at the seat. Former Sheriff's Commander Dave Myers is planning to announce his candidacy on August 26th at the Hall of Justice at 10:30 a.m., according to a spokesperson for Myers. Myers previously challenged Gore unsuccessfully for the seat. In a 2017 interview with East County Magazine, Myers pledged a transparent top-to-bottom review of the department if elected, with goals that include restoring community trust, improving diversity, addressing hate crimes, improving response times in rural areas, and restoring the sheriff's Facebook page, which was taken down during Gore's term. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
Candidates have until August 6th at noon to file papers to run for La Mesa City Council in a November special election. The field is growing crowded, with eight candidates who have pulled papers so far to run, although one told us he has decided to drop out. The candidates are vying to fill a vacancy left by Dr. Akilah Weber's election to the State Assembly. The election follows a turbulent year that included civil unrest, a riot, and the COVID-19 pandemic in La Mesa. In alphabetical order, here are the eight candidates who have so far filed papers to run as of our show taping deadline. Mejan Afshan, daughter of Afghan refugees, grew up in La Mesa and City Heights, according to her bio. She is the co-founder of Borderlands for Equity, a civil rights nonprofit, and a founder of the East County Justice Coalition. She has worked for the International Rescue Committee, CARE San Diego, and she's treasurer of the San Diego Refugee Forum. She also worked for House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, then San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom, and the San Diego County Democratic Party. Letitia Dickerson is running on a platform of rebuilding La Mesa, including faith, community, and public relations. Formerly homeless, she went on to own two businesses, according to her website. She's vice president of SoCal Day of Hope, an ordained minister, and president of Floodwaters Ministry, doing outreach to people in need. A longtime East County resident and African American, she previously ran for El Cajon City Council and was a registered Republican at that time. Her focus would include helping the homeless and veterans, affordable housing, and aiding residents and businesses emerging from the pandemic. Patricia Dillard says she's running to provide all of Masons with access to economic opportunities, healthy neighborhoods, and a high-quality education. Her campaign website says she's lived in La Mesa since 1996 with her family. A registered Democrat and a minister's wife, she works with Western Capital Mortgage and holds a master's degree in organizational leadership. Currently, she serves as vice chair of La Mesa's Community Police Oversight Board. Laura Lothian, a realtor with a business in the La Mesa Village, has run on a pro-business platform multiple times in the past for council and mayor unsuccessfully. In 2020, she was endorsed by the County Republican Party. She also serves on the La Mesa Village Association Board, the merchants group representing the downtown area, and she's called for beautification of the village. She supports police and opposed formation of the Community Police Oversight Board. Jose Fernandez previously pulled papers to run for La Mesa Council in May 2018, but ultimately did not run. He told us at that time that he worked in procurement for an aerospace contractor, is an immigrant who lived in La Mesa since 1989, and hoped to get the Republican Party endorsement then. Michelle Loudon is among the latest to announce her candidacy. She has not returned our email or phone messages, and an internet search did not find any information yet on her candidacy. Tony Orlando pulled papers to run, but later told us that he's decided not to run and will instead endorse Lothian. He serves on La Mesa's Personnel Appeals Board and is pastor of Life Point Church. Jim Stieringer, former La Mesa City Treasurer and Treasurer of the Grossmont Healthcare District, has also served on the Grossmont High School District Board. Stieringer lost his reelection bid on the high school board in 2020 after redistricting, drawing criticism for a mailer that identified himself as part of a progressive team, although he was registered as a Republican. Stieringer is a retired U.S. Air Force captain and a retired contracts manager for Teledyne Ryan. Now, there's still time for more candidates to file to run, so if you don't like those choices, the deadline for you to file is August 6th at noon. Appointments are required in advance with the city clerk. A candidate must be a resident and registered voter in La Mesa, a U.S. citizen, and over 18 years old by Election Day. You can get more information at the City of La Mesa's website. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
A groundbreaking measure to reduce plastic waste has just qualified for the 2022 ballot. The proposal would give companies a big incentive to reduce plastic packaging by taxing each item by one penny. It would also make producers meet certain goals for recycling and reuse. Jennifer Fearing is a legislative advocate advising the nonprofit Oceana. She says that would raise about $1 billion a year.
That would go to funding local governments so that they can upgrade waste and recycling systems to support broader waste reduction, recycling, and composting. And then the final 30% would go to environmental mitigation.
The American Chemistry Council opposes the measure, proposing instead a more lenient national plan to require all plastic packaging to be made of 30% recycled material by 2030. The ballot initiative would ban styrofoam food packaging and would apply to all plastic packaging and foodware, including items sold in stores, restaurants, and online. A huge percentage of the items consumers try to recycle actually end up in landfills, and now many foreign countries are refusing to take our trash. Fearing says throwaway plastics are causing widespread environmental degradation.
Plastics are just choking stormwater drains, water treatment and sewer systems. They're showing up in the form of microplastics in the oceans and in freshwater.
A 2020 study in the journal Science predicted that with current consumption patterns, the amount of plastic waste in our rivers, lakes, and the ocean will more than triple by 2050. This is Suzanne Potter for California News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org. Despite decades of juvenile justice reforms, California is still incarcerating kids of color much more often than their white peers, according to a new analysis. Research collected by the Sentencing Project shows black teens are 9 times more likely to be locked up than white teens, and that's actually a slight improvement over 2015. Report co-author Josh Rovner says one big factor is the fact that communities of color are much more heavily policed.
And so when youth of color experiment with marijuana, they're much more likely to do so in public spaces where they're likely to be arrested for it, whereas white youth living in suburbs might be doing it in a parent's basement. and there's no police around to see that.
The report says in California, Latino youth are almost 2.5 times as likely to be incarcerated as white teens, which is an 11% improvement since a decade ago. But the disparity for Native American youth has more than doubled over the past decade. They are now almost 4.5 times as likely as white teens to be incarcerated. California keeps kids out of jail by favoring drug courts, restorative justice, and family counseling. Detention facilities have emptied out. In fact, the state's juvenile justice system now has about 700 kids behind bars, compared with 10,000 in 1996. Daniel McAleer with the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice in San Francisco says it's notable that this was achieved even as the population soared and juvenile crime rates plunged to record lows.
The crime rates are 80% lower than they were 25 years ago. And no one has really explained it, but one thing we do know is that this is the best behaved generation on record.
This summer, California closed its last three state juvenile facilities and will now try to help justice-involved youth in county programs so they can maintain ties with family and community. This is Suzanne Potter for California News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
You're invited to explore some of Julian's most beautiful trails in the Julian Hiking Challenge. Entrants must complete 5 specific hikes in the Julian area, then post selfies to share at visitjulia.com after each hike. Also share on social media with the hashtag Julian Hiking Challenge 2021. Participants will receive a certificate, sticker, and entry into a drawing to win a Julian goodie bag of keepsake items. The first 300 to complete the challenge will also receive a Julian Hiking Challenge patch. The 5 trails are Stonewall Peak Trail in Cuyamaca Rancho State Park, Vulcan Mountain Summit Trail, the Santa Isabel Nature Center Loop Trail, the Kanaka Loop Trail, and Upper Creek Trail, also in the Santa Isabel Preserve. There is also a bonus hike on the Anaha Trail in Cleveland National Forest, which is pet-friendly. You can find more details on the Julian Hiking Challenge at www.julianhiking.com. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Angela Kurish.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Priebel, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia, and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show. A free press is the foundation of our democracy. You can support independent public media for our region by making a donation or a sustaining monthly pledge of any amount at www.knsj.org. We're your community radio station, KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, serving the San Diego border region from the mountains to the sea. That's www.knsj.org.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.